Blog Talk Radio.
He's here. Flat if you spot the heat around the corner.
Now, my life's a disaster zone because I spend all my time chasing guys like you around the block.
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best, trying to stop guys like me.
You've been walking through our life dead.
All I am is what I'm going after.
From The Godfather to Scent of a Woman.
What do we got?
From Raging Bull to Goodfellas.
Soon they got our phones, soon they got our houses, soon they got us.
Their performances have created a legacy of landmark films.
I want full surveillance. That's 24 hours, round the clock. We never close, open 7 days a week.
Now, for the first time, America's two most electrifying actors collide.
The sky doesn't shoot, you should pass.
The bank is worth the risk.
You should take it down. 12.2 million.
You're risk versus reward, baby.
You're fugitive number one with a bullet.
I'm double the worst trouble you ever had. If I'm there and I gotta put you away, I won't like it. But I'll tell you, you are going down. What if you do got me boxed in? And I gotta put you down. Because no matter what, you will not get in my way. I will not hesitate for a second.
Welcome to the first part of a new series for Movie Geeks United, celebrating the new classics, and our inaugural show will be dedicated to Michael Mann's epic 1995 crime drama, Heat. All the Movie Geeks are here. First of all, I'm Jamie, and Jerry's here. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, what's up?
And Chris is here. Hey, Chris.
Hey, what's going on? Wait a minute, I thought we were celebrating Meet Wally Sparks.
That's the second episode.
My bad.
And also we have our good buddy Jason O'Brien. He hosts his own Blog Talk Radio show called Oscar Oscar every Monday night at 11 p.m. Eastern and 10 p.m. whatever that time frame you're in, Jason. Central? What is that?
Yeah, Central. That would be. Yeah.
Welcome, Jason.
Thank you. Well, see, I knew it wasn't me, Wally Sparks, but I thought we were talking about the 1972 Heat. But okay.
Oh,
that's a good.
It was from the Andy Warhol factory. Yeah,
you're coming out of the gate right away with your research. Wasn't there a Burt Reynolds film called Heat as well?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yes, there was.
Heat, yes.
That's
there's
right.
There's a lot of heat out there.
There's a lot
absolutely.
Of heat. Body heat too. I mean,
and here too.
Red heat. Yeah. Anyway, let's. I want to start out. This is just going to be a very kind of relaxed. Jam session between the four of us about our love for this movie. I want, as we normally do with these kinds of shows, you guys tell me about the first time you saw Heat and your impressions of it. Jason, since you're the guest of honor tonight, I'll start out with you.
I'm glad you played that trailer because that brought back vivid memories of that first time I saw that trailer and just, you know, seeing that, you know, because, of course, the whole excitement was, you know, Pacino and De Niro were going to be in the same scene together, you know, so you heard about that. So that was kind of the whole draw for it. But then actually, you know, seeing the movie and, you know, seeing what Michael Mann did with it with all the different elements that I'm sure we'll talk about tonight, I mean, it was just such an overwhelming experience. And I was so glad, like, this first meeting of these two great acting legends turned out to be something really unique.
And I was
blown away by the movie.
And so good, too, that you didn't mind the fact that they just had one scene of one meaty scene together in it. Because the film surrounding them was so rich. And
it made that particular scene even that much more powerful.
And it's a powerful scene.
Yeah.
Right.
A big centerpiece, obviously the centerpiece of the movie is that scene, and it'll be the centerpiece to this show as well. Chris, how about you, man?
First time I saw Heat was in the theater when it came out. I was actually on a trip. It was my first trip to New York City, and I went and saw it in New York City. I was 15 years old with a buddy of mine that was on the trip with me. And we just, you know, what can you say about the first? It's one of those movies that the first time you see it, it's, you know, it's great, but it's you can't even take it all in. It's just too much, you know. It's like spending a week in New York City. It's not enough time, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's one of those movies that thankfully DVD let you experience over and over again, and it just gets so much better every time you watch it. It was just a really incredible experience. And like you're saying, they only have that one scene together, but there's such a great movie surrounding that one scene, and there's so many other great performances in the movie, too. I mean, literally, no bad performances in the movie of these great character actors and people that pop up every time I watch them. Like, oh, I forgot that, you know, Ted Levine was in this, and he, you know, all these other smaller parts that are just brilliant surrounding the two obvious powerhouses that are in it, you know.
Yeah. Jerry?
I think I took the day off from work to go see it when it opened, if I'm not mistaken.
That's my man right there.
I wore a Reservoir Dogs t-shirt to see it, too, and then I went back the following Monday to take a friend of mine to see it because, like you said, there's so much to take in. But I think, you know, you go to see it because, you know, Pacino and De Niro, but you there's so much more in it, and you really realize with this film what a genius Michael Mann is. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about it. And what I think is very important is to look at this film, and also Casino came out just 2 or 3 weeks earlier.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And these are by both seasoned directors, and I think both of them, in one sense, I know Scorsese was Casino, I think had something to prove to the younger guys making crime films, but it was like something, we do this, and we do this better than anyone else. And there's a strong argument to be made that Michael Mann may do it better than anyone.
There's also two things that brings up. First of all, a terrific year for De Niro.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are two just perfection, these two performances. And secondly, you know, Michael Mann has done a lot of terrific films. Mm-hmm. But I was watching the commentary for JFK not too long ago, and Oliver Stone was watching JFK, and he said, "This is my Godfather." And I think as good as Michael Mann's films are, I think Heat is his Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was so excited about seeing it, obviously, because I'm the major Pacino freak that I am.
Yeah.
And it was built up because of the Clash of the Titans and the film, and I knew that Michael Mann could handle a crime drama, and I knew that it was on an epic scale, and they came out with like two or three different trailers for it, and I was managing the theater at the time, so it was overwhelming, my anticipation for this thing. And I remember the night before I previewed it, there was some kind of review on CNN of it, and they said, "Who wins between De Niro and Pacino in the bout of acting, the acting bout?" And the critic said, "I favor Pacino in the movie over De Niro." And I started screaming. I was like, "Yes, yes, that's my Pacino." I watched the movie, and I was completely overwhelmed by it. It was so much more than I thought it would be, and I was expecting, you know, lots from it.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly for the peripheral characters, you know, it, and just the immersive quality of that world that he created and how detailed it was. And I thought De Niro was stunning.
Yes.
And De Niro was the one I was with throughout the whole movie. And it took about 10, 11 viewings for me to get the rhythms of Pacino and for Pacino's performance to start making sense to me. But that's partly why I think he's such a great actor, because there's more to discover of his work the more you watch it, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not just all laid out on the table. I wanted to talk a little bit about how this movie came to be and how it fits into Michael Mann's resume. Michael Mann has always been preoccupied with people at work, first of all,
mm-hmm.
The criminal element as well, from his earliest days. I mean, you can look at stuff like, obviously Miami Vice is there, but a movie like Thief, you know, the career criminal, the kind of romanticized lone career criminal. But also he had this idea much earlier because he had read of an exchange between a detective and a career thief.
Right.
Chuck Adamson, I believe, was his name.
I think
in 1963. He was following this thief. He was trying to nab him. And he had great admiration for him because detectives love a good challenge. They kind of respect a very talented thief, as this guy was. And by happenstance, in 1963, they happened to have run into each other. And he said, "Can I buy you a cup of coffee?" And they sat down, and they shared their dreams. They shared kind of a very special conversation that really went in depth about their views on life and their views on work. And during that conversation, they each admitted to the other that it will probably come about that one of us will kill the other. And it was a fascinating exchange that became the nucleus of what Heat would eventually become. And Michael Mann actually got a chance to do Heat as a TV movie. I believe it was 89. It was called L.A. Takedown. And when you watch L.A. Takedown, it plays as like a dry run of what Heat would eventually be. Just let me get some people together, get the neighbors together, and let's put on a little a little run through of a very early draft of Heat.
Right.
And I've got some clips of L.A. Takedown. I've got one clip of L.A. Takedown, and it's fascinating how close it is to the eventual film Heat, and yet worlds apart. And that'll bring us to the diner scene as well. So let me go ahead and play these back-to-back. I'm going to play the diner scene from L.A. Takedown and the diner scene from Heat. This is have you guys ever heard the diner scene from L.A. Takedown?
No, I haven't. I'm very curious.
This should be interesting.
Yeah, this is good stuff. So this clip runs about 9 minutes, just to let you guys know. I wanted to fit it all in here. It's very illuminating. So here it is.
7 years in McNeil.
Yeah.
McNeil's no country club.
You looking to become a penologist?
You looking to go back? I chased down crews. The guys are just looking to go back.
You must have worked some pretty bad off crews.
I worked all kinds.
You see me doing thrill seeker liquor store holdups with a Born to Lose tattoo on my chest?
No.
Right. And I am never going back.
Don't take down scores.
That's my job. I do what I do best. Take down scores. You do what you do best, trying to stop guys like me. End of story.
You know, whatever happened to a normal type life? You ever thought of that?
Family breakfasts and barbecues? Kids on Sunday afternoons, that life? That's nice. Is that your life?
At this point in time, no. My life is more like a disaster area. I got a great woman I'm truly in love with, but I'm probably losing her because I spent all my time chasing guys like you around the block. So right now I'm alone.
Then where's all the good stuff?
I don't know. What are you, a monk?
No. I got a woman.
What do you tell her?
I tell her I sell swimming pools.
And live a life so there's nothing in it you can't walk away from in 10 seconds flat.
Yeah.
So what if you spot me around the corner? You can do what you're supposed to, just walk away? Not even say goodbye?
That's a discipline.
And what you're left with is pretty empty.
Yeah. So then you and me, we should both go do something else, pal.
I don't know how to do anything else.
Neither do I.
You know, we're here sitting talking. And if I'm there when you're coming out of the score, I'll blow you out of your socks. I won't like it, but I won't think twice about it. Because if the wife of some poor bastard you kill is going to be made into a widow, or you're going to go down, brother, hey, you're going to go down. Because you don't have to be here. You could be a mailman.
Well, there's a flip side to that coin. Now that we've been face to face, I'd as soon let you walk on by. But if you're there and you got me boxed in, I'll put you down. I'll do what I gotta do, and you will not get in my way. But then again, maybe it'll never happen.
Maybe. Maybe not. 7 years in Folsom. In the hole for 3. McNeil before that. McNeil is tough as they say.
You looking to become a penologist?
You looking to go back? You know, I chased down some cruise guys just looking to fuck up, get busted back. And you?
You must have worked some dipshit cruise.
I worked all kinds.
You see me doing thrill seeker liquor store holdups with a Born to Lose tattoo on my chest?
No, I do not.
Right. I am never going back.
Then don't take down scores.
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best, trying to stop guys like me.
So you never wanted a regular type life?
The fuck is that? Barbecues and ball games?
Yeah.
This regular type life, that your life?
My life? No, my life. No, my life's a disaster, so. I got a stepdaughter so fucked up because her real father's this large type asshole. I got a wife. We're passing each other on the downslope of a marriage, my third. Because I spend all my time chasing guys like you around the block. That's my life.
Guy told me one time, don't let yourself get attached to anything you are not willing to walk out on in 30 seconds flat if you feel the heat around a corner. Now, if you're on me and you got to move when I move, how do you expect to keep a marriage?
Well, that's an interesting point. What are you, a monk?
I have a woman.
What do you tell her?
I tell her I'm a salesman.
So then if you spot me coming around that corner, you're just going to walk out on this woman? Not say goodbye?
That's the discipline.
That's pretty vacant.
Yeah, it is what it is. It's that or we both better go do something else, pal.
I don't know how to do anything else.
Neither do I.
I don't much want to either.
Neither do I.
You know, I have this recurring dream. I'm sitting at this big banquet table and...
All the victims of all the murders I ever worked are sitting at this table, and they're staring at me with these black eyeballs because they got eight-ball hemorrhages from the head wounds. And there they are, these big balloon people, because I found them 2 weeks after they'd been under the bed. The neighbors reported the smell. And there they are, all of them just sitting there.
What do they say?
Nothing.
No talk?
Just, they don't have anything to say. We just look at each other. They look at me. And that's it. That's the dream.
I have one where I'm drowning. And I gotta wake myself up and stop breathing while I die in my sleep.
You know what that's about?
Yeah. Having enough time.
Enough time? To do what you want to do?
That's right.
You doing it now?
No, not yet.
You know, we're sitting here. You and I are like a couple of regular fellas. You do what you do, I do what I gotta do. And now that we've been face to face, if I'm there and I gotta put you away, I won't like it. But I'll tell you, if it's between you and some poor bastard whose wife you're gonna turn into a widow, brother, you are going down.
There's a flip side to that coin. What if you do got me boxed in? And I gotta put you down. Because no matter what, you will not get my way. We've been face to face, yeah. But I will not hesitate. Not for a second.
Maybe that's the way it'll be. Or, who knows?
Or maybe we'll never see each other again.
Yeah, it's like night and day. And actually,
yeah,
the L.A. Takedown, was, I think it was shot something like 10 days,
yeah,
which is about the time that they took to shoot the shootout bank robbery scene in
yeah.
Heat. So, and one of those actors in L.A. Takedown was actually an actor that I kind of like. I can't think of his name. Alex...
I was going to ask you who the actors were.
Alex MacArthur. He played the psycho in Rampage.
Oh yeah.
Huh. Yeah.
It's funny. As I'm listening to that, I'm like thinking. I hear the first scene, and of course it's, you know, I mean, like, to call them similar is an understatement.
Right.
But I have this mental image, and I'm sure L.A. Takedown's a fine movie. I've never seen it, but if it's Michael Mann, I have no doubt.
Right.
But I have this mental image of these two guys in 1995 going to see Michael Mann's new movie. And all of a sudden, like, this scene comes up and their jaws hit the floor. It's like you go, it's like you are building a sculpture and then, like, Michelangelo moves next door and starts building a sculpture right next to you, you know? Like,
right.
That's a good analogy, Chris. I'm sort of dumbfounded how identical.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really, but I think what's amazing about that scene, though, is, like, it with De Niro and Pacino, it takes on such a different dimension. I mean, you could honestly say they're talking about their acting in one sense, I mean, which a lot of people brought up. But it's just, I was not aware it was that similar, the dialogue was.
A lot of the movie follows the same through line, and a lot of the same events and same conversations occur in the TV movie. Obviously, the TV movie is 90 minutes. But it's interesting because in the TV movie they meet in the parking lot. They're both getting out of their car, and they kind of have a tense, shared gaze before he asks them for a cup of coffee. And Macaulay's character, which I think is named differently in the movie Heat, is wearing the same thing De Niro's wearing, the gray suit with the white button-down shirt.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something about the cafe scene, too. How hypnotic it is, how much it, more that it feels like it's allowed to breathe than the L.A. Takedown version.
Well, and there's Annalini's.
Yeah.
I mean,
It's
just quite a place to go. I mean, if you've ever been there, it's, wow, yeah, it's that kind of place, yeah.
It's interesting, too. It's kind of a testament to Michael Mann. It's not, as I'm listening to that, it's not the first time he's done this. Of course, he did it with Miami Vice, too, you know. He's a director that's not, and a writer that's not afraid to go back and try and do something a different way, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, yeah, he calls it something else, and he gives the characters different names, but he's not afraid to go back and perfect something that wasn't exactly perfect. Or, you know, and who knows why L.A. Takedown wasn't what he wanted it to be. It probably wasn't his fault. He probably had constraints from whoever he was making it for and whatnot. But for whatever reason, thank God he decided to go back.
Well, it's Art Linson, who I was watching a documentary tonight, and Art Linson said, you know, you have to make this into a feature film.
Yeah.
This isn't gonna. You've got to really go back, and this begs to be put on the big screen.
It's a it's a dynamic that really fascinated him.
Mm-hmm.
But with that coffee table scene, it starts, and you hear the clanging of, in the diner and everything.
Yeah.
And then as they get deeper into their conversation, this is where sound comes in, too, and he is astonishing with sound and visual, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
That sound, that external sound of the diner, all the goings-on there, becomes muted.
Mm-hmm.
And then that very soft music cue starts, and you just become lost in the connection between these two.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it ends, when the spell is broken, maybe we won't see each other again. The diner sounds come back in
mm-hmm.
before the end of the scene. And it's something very subtle that plays with you in that scene. It makes you feel more connected to it.
And see, this is something that's always fascinated me. I mean, playing those two examples, you know, side by side is the little choices that you make for a film that can make it something that can be considered a masterpiece and something that might just be a regular police procedural or something.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the choices in, like you said, the music, the sound, obviously acting. I mean, acting is such a huge part of what makes something so successful.
Right.
You know, just seeing that together is just, it's amazing when you have an opportunity to do something again and you make those different choices, then you're talking about something that's become like a masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I don't think they rehearsed that scene. I think they shot it maybe 8 times.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like any other scene for them. And yet, you know, everyone in the crew knew that this was something historic.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, Jerry, when we interviewed Richard Cox on that Pacino show?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he talked about, he heard that there were alternate takes somewhere. And it's a real illumination into the difference in approach between Pacino and De Niro.
Because
De Niro, he finds his note, and he sticks to it.
Right.
And Pacino, he said that Pacino was singing dialogue one take. He
mm-hmm.
was doing it wildly different from take to take. And that's the kind of difference between these two performances in it. I mean, it's easy to categorize them as hot and cold. They're both similar in that they're almost like the Walking Dead, you know. They're like night zombies,
mm-hmm.
but they're both obsessives about work.
Yeah,
But at the same time, Pacino is very bombastic, as we know Pacino to be, and De Niro is icy cold, and yet he allows his passion into his life. But he's very efficient,
mm-hmm.
Very tightly wound.
You gotta believe that. I do feel like that's probably one of the only scenes in the history of filmmaking where nobody had to say quiet on the set beforehand. Everybody was saucer-eyed, ready for that scene. Like, they probably didn't have any prep to do before they showed up on set. Like, it was all ready to go. Let's see mm-hmm. these two go at it. You know.
Yeah. I would like to say something though about the, you know, we talk about the Pacino's bombast and all that. I don't think it hurts his performance in this film, though. I actually think, especially in the second half of the film, I just watched it again last night for the first time in a couple of years, I actually think it's wildly appropriate for the character.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. And, I, you know, people use it as an excuse against him a lot, but I really think for Vincent Hanna, it's totally appropriate, and it makes for a very wild, enjoyable performance, especially the scene with the TV set.
Yeah, which we'll be playing in a little bit. But the part of it too is that I thought that he was doing the Pacino bombastic thing, and this is coming from his biggest fan.
Yeah.
And it took me out of it, because De Niro was being so subtle, but
mm-hmm.
Pacino is also very subtle in the movie. The more I watch it,
mm-hmm.
but then I found out about the real part, the real character, his counterpart.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, okay. That's actually this guy.
Yeah.
He's got this guy down.
Mm-hmm.
He's ferocious. He's startling. But amazing.
It just makes him more complex.
Mm-hmm.
It does, and it's good counterpoint to De Niro as well.
Oh, it's excellent mm-hmm. counterpoint to De Niro.
Just like Wayne Grow is good counterpoint to De Niro. Wayne Grow, actually the psychotic, played by Kevin Gage, who's just frightening in the movie.
Oh yeah.
He makes you sympathize with De Niro more.
Cool,
I think.
Right.
I think without Kevin Gage's role there, De Niro would come across as possibly more of a shady, bad villain. You know,
it's
a stereotypical villain.
Well,
he's the principled criminal. You know.
Yeah, he goes after him. When he goes after him in the last third, I mean, I think it's an excellent counterpoint to Wayne Grove, because I think that's the part of the genius. Like we were talking about the smaller characters. I mean, the addition of Wayne Grove, you have this psychotic on your crew who changes everything, who creates more obstacles, more problems for you. I mean, just work of genius. Just a very fascinating character. And I think that's what I like about De Niro's character, because as Jason said, a principled criminal, but he has these morals that he lives by, a code that he lives by. And Wayne Grove is the antithesis of that.
Yeah. Here's I had something of De Niro. Here's something to illustrate the difference between De Niro and Pacino, their approach in the movie.
Yeah, Roger Van Zandt. Yeah, who's this? You know what this is. Yes, I do.
I sent a guy to deliver the package.
He didn't call. Is everything right?
Tell you what, forget the money.
What?
Forget the money.
It's a lot of money. What are you doing? What do you mean, forget the money?
What am I doing? I'm talking to an empty telephone.
I don't understand.
Because there was a dead man on the other end of this fucking line.
Game.
Oh, man, where's your empathy, brother? It's the substance of
empathy
problem.
Was yesterday. Today, you're wasting my motherfucking time.
Listen, man, look.
You fall in love? Come on. Did you fall in love last night? Went off somewhere?
Vincent.
Just tell me that. I'll settle for it. You know what I mean? I'll buy that.
Vincent.
Give me all you got!
Vincent.
Give me all you got!
I swear, my brother Richard's gonna talk to you.
Man. I heard Richard.
Where's Laura?
She's at Lisa Beth.
Look, this has nothing to do with me. I didn't know. I'm terribly sorry.
What are you sorry about? Sit down.
Don't you even get angry?
I'm angry.
Oh.
Yeah? I'm very angry. Ralph, you know, you can ball my wife if she wants you to. You can lounge around here on her sofa in her ex-husband's dead tech post-modernistic bullshit house if you want to. But you do not get to watch my fucking television set.
Watch this.
Excuse me,
Tim, wait,
I gotta clean
that.
Wait,
can I help you? Are you Alan Marciano? Yeah, and who the fuck are you? How am I? Hey! Lieutenant hey. Vincent Hanna, LAPD. LA, this is Las Vegas. You don't even have jurisdiction here. Hey! I don't know who the fuck you guys think you're pushing around, but I know people here, okay? Las Vegas PD takes you into custody. You are extradited to Newark on a New Jersey warrant for smuggling cigarettes up from North Carolina 3 years ago, or you go to work for us. Cut and dried. That is it. Oh, shit. Charlene Shaherless. Who? Who? Who?
Were you fucking owl?
The lady you've been talking dirty to on telephone every day last week.
Yeah, all right. You know what? You can't tie me to her.
Yeah, well, who needs to? Because your ass is on a plane back to New Jersey, Jagoff.
Oh, man, I just... I want to get mixed up with that bitch.
Because she got a great ass! And you got your head all the way up it!
Jesus.
Ferocious, aren't I? When I think of asses, woman's ass, something comes out of me.
So?
So? No big thing. All I want is her husband and his whole fucking crew. Now you're going to work with Sergeant Drucker here.
Yeah. So, there's your seat.
That's my favorite all-time quote. That's my motto for life. When I think of a woman's ass, just something comes out of me. Sorry.
But that illustrates kind of the difference in tone. De Niro's very, very threatening. You have no reservations that he would... that he can resort to violence.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But he's so efficient in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and the other performances in the film, that's what's so special about Heat, and it's what elevates it from the typical cops and robbers genre, is how much attention it pays to the characters, the supporting characters,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
down to the smallest supporting characters. You've got great actors. You've got Kilmer. You've got Tom Sizemore.
And a great performance from Sizemore. I mean,
great performance. Yeah, yeah. John Voight, almost and incredibly, he's a really imaginative actor, John Voight, and he creates a character that's, I think, not even on the page, because there's not that much there, but he makes it so specific.
I think it's,
yeah, it makes
based
it unique.
On
I mean.
Eddie Bunker, isn't his character Nate kind of based on Eddie Bunker, who wrote No Beast So Fierce and you know, the prison writer who also Animal Factory and was also in Reservoir Dogs.
Right, Mr. Brown. Yeah,
yeah.
That was my understanding, was that's who that character was based on.
Yeah.
Right. And of course, Ashley Judd. And that's another thing about it, the women in the film. And this is the one reservation about the movie that I have. I think it's great. They really go into detail about the relationships between these characters to each other and with their mates, and I think that deepens the scope of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And there's even some stuff with Sizemore, some deleted scenes of Sizemore with his family,
mm-hmm.
and giving a present to his children, and
right.
that makes it adds extra volume to the scene where he tries to shield himself with a child
right.
in the shootout.
That yeah.
But the way some of these women are written, particularly Diane Venora's role. And there's psychology throughout Heat, kind of psychobabble, but from that character it feels particularly pretentious to me. Your thoughts? Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
yeah, I know what you mean. When she's talking to Vincent in particular, like when she goes on about sifting through the detritus and all that
mm-hmm.
kind of stuff. Like it doesn't seem entirely natural. It doesn't seem necessarily like the way people talk.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't think it's not terribly distracting for me. I don't know if I would call it pretentious. She just strikes me as a real intellectual. I'm not even sure if we ever find out what it is she does for a living.
Yeah, I don't
in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but I get the impression that she is in. I don't know. Maybe it was just me throwing that onto the movie, but I always got the impression that she was in some sort of intellectual field, whether it's psychology or psychiatry or something like that, because she's analyzing the
yeah very
character
analytical.
So
yeah, she is. Yeah.
And
but,
she might be reflective of, you know, it sounds so surface, but she might be reflective of the house that she lives in, you know, that
yeah.
the ex-husband left her, you know, what the dead tech, postmodernistic bullshit house.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
you know, that's probably where she's coming from, and she's on Prozac all the time, and she's an unhappy person.
Well, she has the one line at the end, though. About that, her daughter, and she goes to Al Pacino. She goes, well, she chose you.
Yeah.
That's, I've always found that to be a devastating line. I mean, I think that says more about her than any other anything else in the film. I mean, that's who, you know, that the, you know, and not even his daughter, but just, he goes, she chose you. I always found it to be a very powerful line.
Yeah, yeah. And the women throughout are, they're different. Obviously, Edie, Amy Brenneman, De Niro's girlfriend, love interest,
mm-hmm.
in the film, is a complete innocent. She doesn't know what she's into.
Yeah, way over her head.
Yeah.
Way, yeah.
Ashley Judd is very assertive, very demanding. That's a passionate relationship between she and Val Kilmer's character, and they fight a lot.
One of her best roles.
Yeah, I think so too. And then you have Diane Venora, who, you know, they're dead to each other. They can't connect.
You wonder what they ever saw in each other, too.
Yeah.
And I'm watching it last night, and I'm just like, what did these two ever see?
Does he propose
like
because she...
Thing. It's a class thing, almost. So they're two totally different ways of life, really.
Well, he proposed because she asked him to.
Right.
There's a scene where they tell each other that.
Mm-hmm.
And then also not to be ignored is the Dennis Haysbert character, which is also an essential part of this film,
mm-hmm.
and that he's the blue-collar criminal.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one trying to go straight. And he has a very loving, supportive woman.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, and that's a very touching scene, and it's a scene that actually in L.A. Takedown, or that character in L.A. Takedown, he just showed up as the driver and then was killed. You had no idea who he was. He was incidental. But it kind of tugs the heartstrings a little bit with Dennis Haysbert and
right.
the way they flesh
yeah,
out that character.
When he's really trying to, you can tell that he's really wanting to, you know, do better. And then when he goes straight into work and, you know, is basically, you know, ripped to shreds, you know.
Another,
like his whole manhood's gone.
Having to give a 25% cutback for good reports as parole officer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bud Cort, you know, Bud Cort out of nowhere.
Court.
Yeah. Jeremy Piven out of nowhere in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to play a deleted clip with Piven in a little bit.
Okay.
I do love that scene where Piven's like, my daughter gave me this shirt.
Yeah.
You know, like it's going to make a difference to this guy right now. Like he thought that was going to, like, you know, tug at his heartstrings. Like he was going to keep his shirt.
Okay. He even says, I don't give a shit who gave it to you.
yeah, you Here's, knew that line was coming. I do want to say, look, it's a movie that is sometimes remembered as an action movie and certainly was sort of sold as an action movie, but like so many great action movies, there's not a hell of a lot of action in it,
mm-hmm.
but when the action does, really, there's only action at the very beginning and at the very end, like,
yeah.
when we,
mm-hmm.
like in the classic sense of the word action, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the middle, and the middle centerpiece,
the
armed robbery.
Right.
That's true. There's some action there. But when you consider the running time of the movie, all told, not a hell of a lot of action in it. But that's not what's important. What's important is all the stuff that's surrounding the action. And when there is action on screen, it's some of the best filmed action. It's the kind of action that directors today need to be looking at and watching and studying because he's so good, just like he's so good with atmosphere, that plays into the action sequences. There's an atmosphere, and not only atmosphere, but a geography to the action
mm-hmm.
sequences
yeah.
that makes
yeah.
absolute sense. You feel like you could have been in that gang, or you could have been following after Vincent Hanna when he's following after the Sizemore character, and you could have, you know, found your way through that labyrinth of downtown L.A. because it's so clear and concise. It's not like all these movies where there's all the, you know, close-ups and the fast cutting. It's very, very concise and very, very clear, you know?
I love his vision of L.A. I mean, he shot this at 85 different locations throughout L.A. And also, I mean, Collateral is a great L.A. movie,
yes,
too.
Yes, it is.
He finds these very unusual locations, and I think that's what he does for inspiration, too. He goes out with a scout, location scout, and just drives the city at all hours of the night. The city fascinates him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in both of those films, he makes the city a character on its own.
Oh, yeah.
And I always want to study how he does it. Because, I mean, it's brilliant how he does that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how many movies do we see L.A. in? And yet they
right.
they don't capture this particular flavor like Michael Mann's work does.
He's able mm-hmm. to really bring it, you know, because you can say, oh, there's like that building or that street or something. You see it countless times, but he really makes you aware of the surrounding. It's not, you know, we take a lot of those images for granted, but not with him. He really does something. He really, like Jason said, it's the city is a character.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And plus, for a crime thriller, there's relatively very little violence in it comparatively. But the violence that is in it matters.
It does. Mm-hmm.
Because you're invested by the time it comes around. We mentioned that Piven scene. Let me play the Piven scene in all its glory. and then I'll play some relationship stuff, the male counterparts and their mates. Here's Piven first.
Bottom line, he's just got the tissue damage, which is good. Clavicle's fractured, though. Can you rest a while?
6-7 hours.
That's it. All right, one other thing.
What's that?
It's got to be 30 thou. Okay, can't be 15.
What is this?
Well, you're fugitive number one with a bullet, all right? It's double the risk here, so I gotta double my price.
You're wrong. It's 4 times the risk. If something happens to him, I'm coming for you. And I'm double the worst trouble you ever had. Take off your shirt.
What?
Take off your shirt.
Yeah. There's Piven scene. And that's actually stuff that was in the trailer and not included in the final cut. That always strikes me as odd when that happens. But and now back to the relationships that we were talking about. Let's play this clip to illustrate the different relationships in the film. And then I want to get into cinematography and music and his use of mood and finally into the robbery, the shootout.
I guess you're shattered.
So why didn't you let Bosco take you home?
I didn't want to ruin their night, too. What was it?
You don't want to know.
I'd like to know what's behind that grim look on your face.
All right, don't do that. You know it. Let's go. Come on.
You never told me I'd be excluded.
I told you when we hooked up, baby, that you were going to have to share me with all the bad people and all the ugly events on this planet.
And I bought into that sharing because I love you. I love you fat, bald, money, no money, driving a bus. I don't care. But you have got to be present like a normal guy some of the time. That's sharing. This is not sharing. This is leftovers.
I see. What I should do is come home and say, "Hi, honey. Guess what? I walked into this house today where this junky asshole just fried his baby in a microwave because it was crying too loud. So let me share that with you. Come on. Let's share that. And in sharing it, we'll somehow cathartically dispel all that heinous shit. Right?
Wrong. You know why?
Because you prefer the normal routine. We fought, then you lose the power of speech.
Because I got a hold on to my angst. I preserve it because I need it. It keeps me sharp, on the edge, where I gotta be.
You don't live with me. You live among the remains of dead people. You sift through the detritus. You read the terrain. You search for signs of passing, for the scent of your prey, and then you hunt them down. That's the only thing you're committed to. The rest is the mess you leave as you pass through. What I don't understand is why I can't cut loose of you.
Hey. Lily.
Let's go, baby. I met the manager. Is that the boss?
Get tired for what that motherfucker does every day.
Baby, can you just handle it till he finds you something new? Can you do that?
Ain't a hard time to invent it that I cannot handle. Hanging with me for a minute.
Because I'm proud of you.
that you're proud of me for.
Come on home.
Take off with me for a while.
Where?
New Zealand.
When?
I have to go separate. You can meet me there.
But my job.
I got money. You don't need money. You could set up a studio to work there.
I don't know.
What's there to know?
Are you married?
What?
You come and go.
Last thing I was married. I'm a needle starting at zero going the other way. A double blank. And all of a sudden, someone like you comes along.
You don't know me, Neil.
I know enough.
Yeah. That's a real, those are three scenes back to back that occur in the movie. And the structure of the movie, the editing of the movie is phenomenal, because when you have that much material, I'm interested to know if it was written in that order, if or how much play there was in the editing room to get the tone just right, to get the back and forth of the different threads of stories right. And editing is obviously a big strong suit of his, but also something that he hates to talk about, which is style. I've read interviews with Michael Mann where he says, I detest style.
Really? And yeah, I've never heard that.
Yeah.
I've never heard that either. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I think he feels that it's reductive, that it's surface and he's getting after something deeper. And I think in his defense, his style is at the service of his movies. It's never
right.
It's never show off. It's never style for style's sake.
There's nothing show off, ironically. I mean, a lot of people would want to give him a hard time for that with the first season of Miami Vice, but after that, I would say, especially with the movies, you could never go after him for that.
Yeah. Yeah. And the use... Go ahead, Chris.
I just want to take a quick minute. I want to read something here, if we can spare a minute.
Yes.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And I'll read it, and then I want to say something about it afterwards. And I'd love to hear. We've touched on it a little bit, the cast of this movie. But let me just read this cast real quick. Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, Val Kilmer, John Voight, Tom Sizemore, Diane Venora, Amy Brenneman, Ashley Judd, McKelty Williamson, Wes Studi, Ted Levine, Dennis Haysbert, William Fichtner, Natalie Portman, Tom Noonan, Kevin Gage, Hank Azaria, Danny Trejo, Henry Rollins, Tone Loke, Jeremy Piven, Xander Berkeley, Bud Cort. Now those are just like the name, the actors that we know. Of course, every character that has even one line in this movie is great. But
yeah,
when I go through that list, even myself when I'm reading that list, and I think of all those characters that every one of those actors played, it's really amazing, because we've seen movies, lots of movies with huge casts of great, not only principal actors, but character actors. But the thing about this movie is, every one of those characters that I just named, and we touched on this earlier, but every single one of them has a complete story that's told in this movie. None of those characters are one-dimensional.
Yeah.
They're all completely rounded characters that you feel like you completely know at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing. And if you were to try to compile I have a hard time believing that, I would say 98.9% of these actors signed on because it was Michael Mann. And he's the kind of guy who could get that kind of talent into a movie like this.
Right.
It's pretty incredible. It really is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And each one of them has a great moment in the film.
Each one of them has a
moment to shine. And as I was watching it again tonight, there's a great moment with Sizemore when he says, you know, Neil says, decide right now, do you want to do this or not? And he says, you know, you have T-bonds, you have stocks, you have a family, you've got money saved, you can walk away from this. And Sizemore looks kind of hurt, and then he turns back around and says, you know, for me, the action is the juice. You know,
yeah,
I'm in. And it's a great little moment that he has.
And he just gives a look. Earlier, Sizemore in the diner, remember, when De Niro roughs up Wainwright?
When he looks at the people behind.
That look, that icy cold stare, just like, just mind your own business.
It's just like the Kevin Gage look when he says, hey, stop talking, slick. When they first meet in the van, and Kevin Gage takes off his sunglasses and just glares at Sizemore.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, just like he says later, he says, the Grim Reaper is visiting with you. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing performances. And Natalie Portman, I mean, highly emotional, and she's another innocent in the film that gets corrupted.
Or Xander Berkeley, one of those character actors that everybody knows his face.
Yeah.
And you've seen him in 1,000 movies, and he's been really great in some movies, and sometimes he just shows up. But in this movie, you don't really get to know the character completely. He's one of the ones that's got less of a rounded character, but with the little bit of time that he has, he just makes the absolute most of it. And you almost feel bad for him by the end of the scene, because you feel like Vincent Hanna's going to rip his face off.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, and also the lonely L.A., the vast place where no one really touches one another.
Yeah.
So many people, and it's potent in Collateral, certainly. That's a major theme of Collateral.
Oh, yeah.
But it's also there in Heat. I mean, it's there between husband and wife that can't connect.
Yeah.
It's there driving in the middle of the night through the L.A. streets, and so much is around you, but you're so isolated at the same time.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's the thing that I think we all like about this movie. You mentioned all these different themes and issues going through it. I'm always amazed that this didn't have a much bigger impact when it came out. But it just... I mean, it works on just so many different levels. I never even thought of it, Chris, as an action film. I never looked at it that way.
Yeah, I didn't either.
I don't look at it that way either, but that's a little bit how it was sold. And
course,
you know, I mean, the poster's got everybody with their guns on
it.
Yeah,
yeah. That's Hollywood for you. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I don't think of it as an action movie either. I think of it as a drama with some incredible action in it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a testament to the movie. Remember last year when Dark Knight came out?
Yes.
It was so hard not to make those comparisons.
Oh,
it really is.
Oh, yeah.
Like, we've seen lots of action movies throughout, you know, the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and here's this movie that came out in 1995, you know, 15 years ago, that people are still comparing action. When people do a really well-made action sequence, this is kind of that sequence at the end is kind of the yardstick these days for a well-made action sequence.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you think, how can another cop and robbers movie succeed after watching Heat? I mean, and honestly, in that genre, no movie has topped it for me since. It's such a worn genre.
Yeah.
And Michael Mann just breathes new life into it.
Yeah, it was a worn genre in 1995 before this movie came out. It's not like it's worn out after Heat. No, it was well worn.
Yeah. At the same time, it was successful critically, certainly.
Oh, yeah,
It didn't tank. It performed respectably.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't a blockbuster like Jumanji was the day it came out. But
No, God, no. But I mean, I think well, you know, remember Entertainment Weekly used to publish these things back. They always said, like, you know, it wasn't a hit, it wasn't a bomb. It's just like, I guess in relation to cost or whatever, it didn't perform as well as they thought. I mean, only in relation to cost. No, I mean, it's a critical, I mean, I forget what the rating is on Rotten Tomatoes as of last year, but it's a huge critical darling.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for a three-hour movie, it for it to have made 75 or whatever it made in the U.S.
That's very impressive,
I don't think you can't complain with those numbers. You really can't.
And it was made at a time when it should have been their last hurrah in that cop genre, you know, because they're at that age where it was right. It was probably the last time they could believably carry off these two performances at their age.
We're just lucky that they didn't get the script for Righteous Kill to be their first. Film to be together.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And of course, Dark Knight and that first bank robbery scene, and even the inclusion of William Fichtner as the bank manager there.
Yeah, there are a couple of films that are very influenced. I mean, big films that are influenced by it. The Departed and the movies the Chinese movies, the Infernal Affairs are certainly influenced by Heat. But The Departed, American Gangster, and obviously Peter Berg, who's Michael Mann's protege, loves that shootout scene especially. But if you look at the action in The Kingdom and the shootout scene in the bank robbery sequence in Hancock, I mean, there's no doubt that Peter Berg is very influenced by Michael Mann.
Well, yeah, and in both films he were produced by Mike.
Yeah, that's, I mean, he said, hey, Mike, do you want to just take over and do, what would you do here?
And Chris, you and I have stood where the bank robbery shootout scene was shot.
Indeed we have, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, and it's amazing. It's an incredible sequence. And I remember when I took a friend to see it, a friend and his wife, the wife said, that's so ridiculous. That would never happen. They would never open fire around a crowd. And first of all, the scene is magnificent. And the sound of the bullets, the sound of the gunfire was so specific.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're shooting at a concrete canyon, essentially. And so that hollow kind of sound that the bullets make, I think they worked very hard on that. But lo and behold, 2 years later, there was a real shootout after a bank robbery in
Hollywood. Yeah.
North Hollywood, right there. And eyewitnesses said that it was actually, the movie felt more real to them.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Here's some of that shootout. I've even got clips of the shootout.
Oh, God, you're prepared.
I got to play the clips. This happened in 97, and their 10th year anniversary, this news station did a report on it.
Police on the scene just driving up, bullets being exchanged, fire being exchanged.
They are images North Hollywood will never forget. 10 years later, they still remember what they saw and what they heard.
You can see a fusillade of bullets into this suspect vehicle as police open fire, and you can see that the suspect is also opening fire straight through the windshield of the car.
The violent shootout was captured on live TV 10 years ago today. A bank robbery gone bad resulted in an hour-long gun battle between two heavily armed suspects and hundreds of Los Angeles police officers.
One bullet hit up there, the shrapnel came over my head, and there was a hole down there that long on the floor, and I got under the table. I've never been able to get down on my knees, but I sure did this time.
The nation watched as two suspects armed with automatic weapons fired more than 1,000 rounds, holding a North Hollywood neighborhood hostage.
I was just finished my shopping and ready to go to my car. And they started shooting.
And suddenly all of the fire started. Bullets were going. They almost hit one woman in the head. It's been a very, very awful experience.
Suspects Larry Phillips Jr. and Emil Montesereno were gunned down, both 26 years old. A dozen police officers and two civilians were wounded.
Yeah. 1,000 rounds. 1,000 rounds in downtown Hollywood.
Yeah. Oh, my.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like Acapulco last weekend in a resort, they had like a huge shootout where a lot of tourists were in danger, and that reminded me of Heat, too. I mean, it's amazing how this stuff happens.
Incidentally, because I forgot to mention this earlier, the real-life kind of Vincent Hanna did kill the real-life Neil McCulley. He was walking out of a bank. He turned around. Hanna drew his gun, but so did Neil. Neil's gun misfired, and Chuck Adamson shot him 6 times and killed him.
Wow, yeah. I did not know that. Okay.
So the movie, I also remember talking to a friend that saw and said, I didn't like who died in the end. I thought it should have been reversed.
I've heard that from a lot of people.
Yeah. And it happened in the end the way it happened in real life. I mean, minus the airport. But, you know, the bad guy got gunned down, the so-called bad guy. Yeah. And it speaks also to the ambition of the film that there were people that felt ambivalent about that. Or that was the wrong way to go. That the bad guy should be the one to get off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as much as you like the Neil McCulley character, again, it goes back to that coffee shop.
Yeah.
And I love the character, but you got to agree with Pacino when he says, if it's between you and some poor bastard whose wife you're going to make a widow, you know, brother, you're going down. And, you know, come on. You got, like, I like movies with, I like the bad guy in movies, too, but I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't have any problems with the end of Heat. Like,
no, I have none.
Right. I have none either. But your sympathies are with De Niro, and your sympathies, and that he has to follow his own code, and when he backs away from her.
Oh, when he backs, it's a devastating scene, still, after all these years. When he backs, with that look on her face. I mean, holy shit. I mean,
it makes that character tragic. It really does.
Right. It makes it tragic. And, of course, she's going to find out that this, you know, this is, it was him, he's the guy that the LAPD gunned down out at the airport. And again, you know, like there's the movie has layers that go beyond what's shot. Like it's,
yeah.
You're thinking about these characters and how these events are going to play out on all these characters' lives mm-hmm. throughout the rest of their,
right.
you know, throughout the rest of their lives. One thing
yeah.
we haven't talked about much that I know Jamie is close to your heart is the score. The score
yeah.
of the movie,
yes.
and I know that, like Steve Martin said, talking about music is like dancing about architecture.
Yeah.
So it's kind of difficult to have a conversation about a score, but it is one of the more perfect scores
mm-hmm.
that's ever been written for a movie.
Mm-hmm. It's a great score.
It's incredibly
score.
Subtle, but incredibly dynamic
mm-hmm.
when it needs to
haunting
be.
Too.
Yes. Yes. Very good
yeah.
word.
Very versatile score, and. Just some completely cool tracks on it. There's even some Moby stuff on there. I mean, Moby provides some of the most memorable tracks on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great score. And since it is so difficult to talk about score, let's play a little bit of it. And this puts you right back in the Heat universe whenever you hear this music played. Yeah, Michael Mann. He's always been acutely aware of music's importance.
Mm-hmm.
And just it creates such a mood. I mean, he used to use all that Tangerine Dream stuff early on in his career.
Yes, he did, yeah. That's right.
That was the hypnotic music back then.
Yeah.
Right. There's something almost like a film out of the 70s kind of score to some of this, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, it's just...
I'd be curious to hear his score for Public Enemies. Mm-hmm. Very curious about that.
That's true. That's true. If he's going to go... I'm sure there'll be older classic songs in there from the period, but if he's going to go strictly score... And this score is diverse. It's more than Elliot Goldenthal. Elliot Goldenthal's five or six tracks out of this 20-track soundtrack, or however many tracks is on there. It's all this diverse range of sources that he picks up music from.
Right.
It's incredible. I want to end. I'm going to take a phone call, and then I want to discuss each one of our favorite moments from the film, so I'll give you a chance to put on your thinking caps.
Mine at work.
That's the typical one, yeah. But
yeah, that's
little acting moments, character moments, moments in the writing, whatever. So let me take this call. I think it might be Aaron. 210, you've been on the phone for a long time. You there?
Hey, guys, what's up?
Hey, dude.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Hey, Aaron.
Hey, how's it going? Been enjoying the discussion. And just to bring a couple of points, you know, a lot to cover real quickly, but it's interesting to note when y'all were first starting talking about L.A. Takedown and just how even back then Michael Mann was kind of feeling his way in the TV movie version. It's interesting to note that this goes back even further, predating Manhunter, when I know William Peterson has talked about how him and Mann were talking about doing Heat and at one time, and then Manhunter came up. So, I mean, so that's like 82, 83 stages of how long this project was gestating for Michael Mann. And the other thing I do want to point out, I was talking to a critic friend of mine who's doing a kind of an overview multi-part video essay on Michael Mann leading up to Public Enemies, and we were talking about how, you know, these recurring themes throughout his films, and we were talking about how Heat, along with all of his other films, most of his films, deal with institutions versus the individual, be it law enforcement, criminality, and Heat, and so forth. And it's interesting how that kind of permeates throughout all these relationships, and even to the point of the Dennis Haysbert storyline, which has always been one of my favorites, that whole arc. I mean, even someone, you know, the Bud Cort character, I mean, he's a manager of a hash house, and he still, with that little power, exerts his will onto someone else. And that's always like a constant theme of a greater entity exerting its will over the individual, and the individual either succumbing to that will or, in the most part, violently acting out against it. I mean, this is even in The Last of the Mohicans.
Right.
So, I mean, it's just Heat. It's one of those American classics. Michael Mann, despite what a couple of critics, naysayers, might think of Michael Mann, they will go nameless on this show. But they know who they are.
Well, yeah. Anyone that listens to the show knows pretty much who we're talking about primarily.
But
we mention him every show.
Yeah. But Michael Mann is one of the great filmmakers of the last 25 years. What's interesting, and this is something I was talking to a friend of mine, is how he's evolved from, if you look at something like Manhunter or Mohicans or Heat, and he controlled every aspect of every frame of every film or every TV show that he worked on, to starting with The Insider, to Robbery Homicide Division, to Collateral, to Miami Vice. It's kind of amazing how he's gotten more and more into the subject matter, he has gotten looser and dirtier and like Happy Accidents, you know.
Yeah.
To the sound, you know, used to be you had to hear every single word and every single dialogue line in a Michael Mann film, to where you go to like Collateral or Miami Vice, you know, he doesn't mind having a sloppiness. You know, Miami Vice is great. I mean, there's thunderstorms in Miami Vice, and Michael Mann doesn't care. He goes, if you can't hear the dialogue because there's thunder, you know, that's too bad. You know, just little things like that. He's gotten kind of grungier and dirtier as he's evolved, and I think he's just, if anything, he's more exciting a filmmaker now than he's ever been. He's just...
Well, my two favorite Michael Mann films are Heat and The Insider, and also your assessment of the institutions and how they impose their will upon others is never more true than in The Insider.
Mm-hmm. Very true.
Both characters are dealing with that.
Both characters are dealing with institutions, and the interesting thing is one of them leaves, breaks from an institution on his own terms, and one doesn't. And the one that doesn't leave on his own terms is probably the greater individual, the greater hero, and he's the one that suffers for it. And that's what the Russell Crowe character, his defiance of an institution is a greater heroic act than the Al Pacino character. But the Pacino character is able to leave the institution of CBS on his own terms, and it's that duality is mirrored. And there's a lot of, I mean, just the recurring images throughout Insider in particular, and just, you know, revolving doors of basically you can just come and go as you please, and in some of these places. And there's always motifs like that. And you mentioned, like, you were talking about how things, you know, the L.A. Takedown coffee shop, you know, the coffee shop scene versus L.A. Takedown versus Heat, how the dialogue didn't change. And it's funny, there's lines of dialogue that pop up in Michael Mann films throughout the years. One of his favorite lines that he always has a woman tell her lover is, "Time is luck." And that pops up in Miami Heat, and that pops up in Manhunter. And that's something very personal to Michael Mann. And the way he views women has evolved. And in his dealing with sexuality, he sees the male protagonist, the only time they have any kind of moment of peace is vulnerability, is when after they've had sex. Be it the sex scene in Heat between Pacino and Diane Venora, or Jamie Foxx's sex scene in Miami Vice.
Yeah. So, and it's interesting that L.A. Takedown, the scene where the female, the mate, tells the male, "I'm proud of you," isn't the character it is in Heat. In L.A. Takedown, it's Hannah's wife.
Right.
Hannah says, I feel like I made no difference today. And she holds him and says, "I'm proud of you." But that's completely different than the relationship built in Heat. Yeah.
And there's about five relationships, fully drawn relationship between men and women in Heat. Pacino, De Niro, obviously, but Tom Sizemore, Kilmer, and even Dennis Haysbert. I mean, those are five right there. And even Danny Trejo, to a lesser extent. I mean, five.
Danny Trejo's so heartbroken when his Anna is killed, and he doesn't want to live, and he has Neil take him out. You know, and
well,
it's interesting that the duality, the duplicity of the criminals, what they do, and how they maintain, you know, Neil's crew maintain healthy relationships. Not Val Kilmer, obviously, but and how you can see De Niro looking at that and feeling like he's missing out somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's at the dinner table, and he sees Tom Sizemore happy with his wife, and everyone's laughing and holding hands and everything, and he's missing that, and he goes and he calls Edie. You know?
Yeah, I mean, he's starting to get attached to something that he's possibly not going to be able to walk away away from in 30 seconds.
He's breaking his own rule, yeah. And also how he takes care of the crew, too, how he spies on Val Kilmer's wife and finds out she's having an affair. To maintain such a tightly controlled crew and to try to get her to stay with him, he's almost breaking his own rule from the beginning because he's allowing opportunities for them not to be able to walk away.
Well, and he has the great line where he tells her, and my word counts, when he
right.
says, you know, I'll stay. But before I let you all, so y'all can name your favorite moment, I want to name my two favorite moments.
Sure.
And one of them is from a character we have not mentioned. And you may think I'm being facetious, but I truly do love the character and the scene, and that is of Tone Loc.
Yeah.
As the informant. And the great line of Chino, Jamie, you could probably do this better than I can.
You get killed walking your doggy.
There you go.
I knew it. Yeah, that's a great
line. It is one of the great lines in the film. And my other moment is he didn't play this part, but when he starts singing.
By the time I get to Phoenix,
which is classic.
If you can get him in that scene, then you've got the rest of the character. The first time I saw that movie, he was jarring to me. But then I accepted him in that first scene, mm-hmm. that interrogation through wildly unpredictable interrogation, intimidation.
Well, what's interesting to note is that the criminals, or the real criminals, these real blue-collar criminals, they're not really thrown by him to a certain extent. They've gone through this before. They
yeah.
know that... they're doing it. The Hank Azaria character is thrown off because he's lived, you know, he's in a cubicle and he doesn't know any better. But these street criminals, Tone Loc or the other guy, Albert, you know, they're not really, they're kind of almost amused by the way Hannah goes by this, and it's almost by the numbers to them, this type of, you know, kind of
yeah.
controlled hysteria that he does. And it's just that's just another wonderful thing. And there's like, and the other person we should mention is, and he also has one scene, is Tom Noonan,
who
sets up the score. And there's the great De Niro asks him, "How do you get this information?" And Noonan says, "Well, it's out there. That's what I do is I just grab it out of the air and figure it out." And so Tom, and as a kind of a weird meta moment, Tom Noonan, the original. Killer from Manhunter, the original Hannibal Lecter film,
mm-hmm.
while in Heat, Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs plays a cop.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that is interesting.
That is very, yeah.
Jason, what's your favorite moment?
Yeah, I've got a couple too. Since I think
okay,
there,
well, you can cheat.
I'll do. Yeah. I'll one of them is I like the moment when they're doing the surveillance and the noise is made, and then
yeah.
you just get the images of Pacino's face. And then De Niro on that, you know, surveillance video kind of thing, and it just kind of goes back and forth, just the silence.
I'm going to steal everyone else's favorite moments because that's one of mine. That's one of the moments
that
astounded me tonight, and it focuses. It's like they're looking straight in the camera almost.
Yeah,
right.
It's right on their faces. It almost is reminiscent of Jonathan Demme. The way he
yep.
tends to shoot people.
Yeah.
It's usually the first scene when I think of Heat, that just for some reason that sequence just comes right to me. Because
yeah.
there's something about that silence that, you know, is going on at that moment where Pacino's thinking, you know, God, maybe he, you know, they didn't hear it or something. And,
mm-hmm.
and then it's just the moment's lost.
And
go ahead.
It has one of Pacino's great flourishes when he literally almost breaks the walkie-talkie because the
yeah.
Yeah,
by
right.
the book.
That's exactly what you're going to do. You're going to let them walk. I have tactical command of this situation. The supersede your ranking. They will walk and you will let them. Fuck! Okay,
and
go
this
ahead,
one
Jason.
This kind of encompasses, it comes from a couple of different scenes, but what I remember most about Heat are the smiles between
yeah.
De Niro and Pacino. You know,
yeah.
I talked about it in the chat first in the diner scene when he says, you know, I don't want to do anything else, pretty much. And Pacino gives him that little smile.
That's
and
a
then,
great.
And then also,
smile.
I love the smile when, and it's a good scene too when, you know, they're surveilling them from that huge, whatever field is, and then Pacino's team goes down there, and you know what they're looking at? They're looking at us. And then you get
that
smile with De Niro.
I love that scene. That's a great scene.
Oh, such a great scene. And you got that smile on De Niro's face as he's taking his picture.
That's
what makes that whole relationship brilliant, is just because you sense that there's that respect between the two.
That's exactly what it's built upon.
This
mutual respect.
So
Yeah.
I mean, De Niro loves it that he's figured it out, you know. That's great.
And then the next scene, they're in the...
Great. Motherfucker!
Then the next scene, they're in the car. He's in the car with Voight. They're reviewing Hannah's file.
He wants
to know more about Hannah.
Right, yeah, exactly.
You with this guy in your tail, you should let this job pass, you know.
Look at this move, the way he moves.
Yeah.
Right.
He's a cowboy, you know. He's been divorced 3 times. Why do you think that is? He likes getting married or something, you know. it's great stuff. Okay, Chris, how about you, buddy?
Those are all great scenes you guys mentioned. It's hard to pick a favorite scene out of this movie, but one of the scenes I love is the coffee shop scene, not between De Niro and Pacino, but the coffee shop scene between De Niro and Amy Brenneman, because...
Yeah.
Without that relationship is really important, because otherwise you got the Neil McCauley character is just, you know, we've seen him thousand badass criminals that we love, and he knows all the moves, and he's the best criminal around. But that's the scene where he is that criminal at the beginning of the scene, and of course, you know, she's just being a sweet girl, and like, just not only did you pick the wrong city to try and strike up a conversation at a coffee shop, you picked the absolute wrong guy in the wrong city. And strike up a conversation.
Absolutely.
And, of course, he comes right over the top with, you know, lady, why are you so interested in who I am and what I do? And then he sort of gets it, like, this woman is just trying to strike up a conversation with me. And that's the first time in the movie that you actually get to see Neil McCauley, not the criminal. You get to see him drop that curtain, and you get to see the real guy, and he sort of takes it easy. And without that scene, I really don't think that character works for the rest of the movie.
That's a good point.
If he just had a girl that you just, you know, if you have to see that relationship develop in that moment to know that he is a real guy. He doesn't just have some floozy that he, you know, bangs when he's in L.A., you know.
Yeah.
That's a really, really important scene and well played.
And he's constantly asking her questions. I mean, that scene and the next scene. It's almost like another interrogation. I mean, he's trying desperately to connect with someone, to feel like he can know someone on the outside. That is a great scene when he softens like that. Yeah. Anything else you want to face?
Well, only every other scene in the entire movie.
I'm with Chris there. Every other scene in the movie.
I am partial to the scene. It's just one of those great twists in a movie where they sort of lure the cops out to that sort of outdoor factory, and it's just, and Pacino sort of slowly puts it together. You know what they're looking at? They're looking at us. You know,
that's
like,
a great
It's a great moment, because you, as the audience, are also unaware, and it was great to sort of be fooled by McCauley and his gang, just like Vincent Hanna was, you know.
Right.
They got him. Like, they're looking at us. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry? You got anything?
Well, I mean, you know, you guys are taking everything already. But two things I do want to point out. I do love the way the parallels between Vincent and Neil, how they're dealing, you know, how, you know, he's, you know, Neil has to go settle scores on the, you know, on the way to the big showdown, and Vincent has his things to do. And I love the parallels there. But one of the scenes I love, because it's just, you never imagine anyone taking down Henry Rollins, and Al Pacino just takes him down. It's a great scene. You're just like, holy shit. I mean, who is this guy? How do you do that? If you've ever seen Henry Rollins in concert or seen him, I mean, you're just like, oh, my God.
Henry Rollins probably thought that was the coolest thing ever. He gets to be beat up by
Al Pacino.
My favorite De Niro moment is in the tunnel when you talk about settling scores.
Yeah.
When he decides that there's time to settle the score with Wayne Grove.
And
you see it building, he can make his escape, but he just can't let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And
he has this kind of
begrudging smile on his face, and he makes the turn off, and he tells Amy Brenneman, "We got time."
Yeah.
That's a great moment.
That is.
Can you sense the tragedy already? I mean, it's just the way that I remember that visual of that turn that he's making.
Yeah.
You know, and there's just something haunting about that scene. You just sense that choice now has sealed his fate.
It's fate. Yeah, it's fate.
Yeah.
And the beautiful physicality of Pacino. There's, like, you talk about the Tone Loc scene. When he walks into that club and the music's going, it's just a very aggressive walk that he has.
Mm-hmm.
Or the scene where you first see him really at work and he takes over the crime scene after the robbery in the beginning.
You pull your hand out of that man's pocket.
Yeah, and his arms, he's got some great physical flourishes going on.
Yeah.
His dialogue, here's just the...
It was $1.6 million in bearer bonds, and they ignored the loose cash.
Because they had no time, because they were on a clock, which means they knew our response time to a 2:11, had our air, immobilized it, entered, escaped in under 3 minutes. It's a good spot here. We got good escape routes, 2 freeways within a quarter of a mile. Traffic video camera, probably disabled. Check it anyway.
You recognize the M.O.?
M.O. is that they're good. Once it escalated into a murder 1B for all of them after they killed the first two guards, they didn't hesitate. Pop guard number 3, because what difference does it make? Why leave a living witness? Drop of a hat, these guys will rock and roll. The shape charge. The shape charge indicates that they are technically proficient. Proficient enough to go in on the prowl, so let's start looking for recent Highline burglaries that have mystified us. Run Slick is an alias to the FBI. You're going to get the phone book. Do it anyway. Who's moving the bearer bonds? Check the usual fences. You and I will check Cusimano and Torino. I want you to take Goldstein and Alfaro. Hang in with forensics. From the bomb squad, I want the explosive. If we're lucky, it's exotic. We can trace the sample.
Yeah. I mean, he's going...
the MO is that they're good.
Yeah.
Quote, too.
Yes, yes. It's such, like, snappy dialogue, too.
Oh, incredible dialogue.
Mm-hmm. And they're describing the crime scene to him that whole time. They're giving him the rundown. And then he takes over. And you see, he's the best at what he does. He's completely in control.
Mm-hmm.
And he has found his great foe. Yeah.
Yep.
It's a great movie, guys.
Timeless.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it'll be a movie that lives? I mean, like, we think back on movies from 30, 40 years ago. Do you think, 20, 30 more years from now, Heat will only gain in stature?
I think so.
I hope so, too.
I hope so, but I think it's up to people like us to do this, too, to be very honest with you. It really is up to us, to do this every couple of months with these movies, to remind people. I mean, we have a lot of loyal fans in the chat room about it, and we have people, tons of people on Facebook and MySpace who commented on this show before it came on, so there is a following. But, I think it's up to us at this point, really, to keep it going, though. Because I think...
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think it's one of those that, it kind of sits in between of, It's clearly it could be up there with a Godfather type masterpiece, but I think in the minds of a lot of people, it's one that they might forget.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is, but it just kind of seems that way with that movie.
The thing is, the best films are the most remembered films. Most of the majority of the remembered films, the ones that 20 years later that they're showing on TNT or HBO.
Mm-hmm.
World, whatever, and it's 2:00 in the morning and people channel surf and they stop, are exceedingly well-made genre films.
Right.
It's only been 3 years, but The Departed has already become kind of a new classic that people will stop and watch. And Heat is one of those films that if it's on TV, preferably HBO or one of the other cable channels where it's not edited, people will stop. And if they not watch the whole thing, they will stop and watch a good chunk of it. And
right.
You mentioned The Godfather. The Godfather, when it first came out, I mean, The Godfather is a genre film. It's a period gangster film.
Yeah.
Updated, raised to art level. And so Heat, it's a contemporary crime film, but it's done at the highest level. I mean, and no, this the other thing that hasn't been mentioned, and I'll mention it because I am excited. I know Jamie is ambivalent about it, and but the fact that the talent is seemed to be intact with it, including Michael Mann, I'm actually intrigued by the possibility of Heat, the video game.
Right.
I find that interesting. I think that could be cool. You know.
Yeah, it just seems to be very reductive again. I mean, I'm no more excited about it than I was a Godfather video game.
I heard none of these games are, you know, they don't have a very long shelf life. People are very excited before they come out, but after they come out, people are almost ambivalent, you know.
But what it does speak to, going back to Will It Be Remembered or Cherished, I guess it has a currency with younger people, with that set that would purchase video games.
Yeah, that's
the
thing. They're not working on a cruising game right now.
You mean there's a cruising game? There's a cruising game? Oh my God! I hope there'll be a Midnight Express game too. I'm getting in line tomorrow morning.
I can't wait for the online play.
Yeah. Okay, I guess that's all we had to say about that.
You get to customize.
That was classic, Chris. That was classic.
Oh, good. Cruising video game. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you guys so much on that note. I appreciate everybody taking part in this. And go rent Heat. I think it'll be out on Blu-ray soon. I sure hope it will.
Yeah, I think
it is. They are remastering it. From what I've read, Michael Mann is requesting a whole new remastering for the Blu-ray, so it's probably going to look even better than it already does.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's exceptional. And it did air on TV. It aired on NBC, I think, first, and then USA Network took it. And it's impossible to watch on TV.
It really is.
When you break the spell, it's
impossible to watch the whole movie. But if you're a dude and you're sitting around and you're flipping channels and you flip to Heat, and you don't stop and watch it for at least a couple minutes, you're a total tool. You're a complete douche if you don't stop and watch.
And I'll take it a step further. Casino, too.
There's the quote of the evening.
That's true. It's very true. And you can't watch it on TV, but you need to get up off the couch, take your ass back to the DVD rack, pull it out, and start watching it again.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Casino is one that we're going to get into in a future episode.
Oh, that'd be great.
That's going to be another one of
that'd
our new
classics.
That'd
be great one to go into, too, yeah.
Oh, that's great. All right, so until then, sorry, I got to be worked up again. I thank everyone for joining us tonight. Join us on Sunday. Chris, will you be available Sunday?
Yeah, no problem.
All right, some great movie talk. We're going to start at 6:30 with the three of us, Chris, and then we'll start out the show with Rufus Sewell. So we'll see you guys on Sunday. Thanks a lot, everybody.
Thank you, everyone.
Yeah, thanks.